dislike it. You know, the having an unusual name is kind of cool. Like, people remember you for your name, if anything else. if not for anything else that I do, but yeah, so it's not a bad thing. My first name's actually Ben.
And your sister has unusual names as well.
What's
your first name, sorry?
My first name's Ben. So I answer to Ben. My middle name's Xavier, but I've been called Xavier ever since I was a kid. So yeah, again, people trying to be unusual. I just grew up with that being a normal thing. But it makes it a nightmare when you try and go to the bank and sign for things and they're like, what's this signature? It's not, there's no B in it.
I never knew your actual name was Ben. Yeah, yeah. And I'm slightly disappointed by that, to be honest.
It makes you sound less exotic. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my middle name is Richard, which is not that exciting because it's the same. So my dad's called Richard. So I basically got
my dad's name
as my middle name.
Yeah, but that's
pretty standard, isn't it?
I think that's decent. Or your granddad's first name or something like that.
Well, my first name would have been Max, but we had a cat at the time called Max. So the cat, obviously, there could be two Maxes. And then my sister was named after Carly Simon, the singer.
Okay.
Which is, and the only song I know that Carly Simon has ever sung is You're So Vain, which is like some 80s hit, I think. And I think basically she got called that because my dad just liked, or my mum and dad liked that song. And then it's spelled exactly the same as Carly Simon's name, which I thought was quite funny. But
you weren't named after it wasn't an Indiana Jones thing where you're named after the dog.
No, I mean, if anything, if I was going to be named anything else, it would have probably been Elton, after Elton John.
That would have been a cool name. I'm not saying Chris isn't a cool name. That would definitely have been a cool name.
I mean, Elton would be a bit cooler than Chris, wouldn't it? But yeah, like, that's purely because like Elton John's my dad's favourite. Yeah. Artist, and to be fair, up there is my mum's. My mum's is David Bowie, and to be honest, I'm glad I'm not called David. But I wouldn't have been called David because I've got an uncle David, so that would have been a weird one.
Process
Elton. Exactly. I mean, Elton would have been quite funny. Apparently not. Apparently they went for Chris. And I asked them why they chose Chris as my first name, and they were just like, oh, I just quite liked it. And I was like, oh.
That's a good read.
That's really boring. I was expecting something a bit more interesting.
The funniest thing I get is when people say to me, oh, you're called Xavier, and then you can see them almost wanting to ask, why do you call yourself Xavier? It's like, I didn't choose that. When I was a kid, I wasn't like, sorry, guys, let's, you know, call it quits. I want to be called this. I could barely spell it until I was like 8. So
I could still barely spell it. I get the first letter done and I'm kind of like, yeah, the rest of it, I'm just going to guess it. It sounds about right. If it's got enough like vowels and consonants in it, it's probably roughly right. That was my theory anyway. So anyway, this is episode 11 of the podcast and I've got Ben, not really. I've got Xavier here from Aero Coach, and we're gonna do a bit of it's gonna be a bit of a geeky one, I think. We're gonna do some speedy, bikey, chatty, stuffy, because there's lots of really interesting things on the aerodynamic side anyway, and who better to talk about it than an absolute expert who has helped me out personally with my fits and getting me really super slippery. And also someone who does just really cool shit. Like, it's cool. And I guess, what else could I say about this? Yeah, like, it's going to be a bit geeky and a bit cool, which is kind of right up my street, to be honest, more than anything. Like, I'm all about the geek sense. And we're recording this on the 15th of April. So the latest that's come out in the news today was the Tour de France. Can't even say it. Tour de France being rescheduled to the 29th of August until the 20th of September. But it's also meant they've tried to juggle around the World Champs, like straight after the Giro, the Vuelta, some cobble classics. And I'll be honest, I take it as being pessimistic, but I don't think it's going to happen. What's your kind of thinking on it?
I mean, I think that obviously it's a good idea to have some kind of a date for the Tour de France, like it is for the Olympics, so that sponsors don't say, right, all cycling's over and we're not going to start helping out the teams, because I think that that would end up with this kind of domino effect and a downward spiral where people start pulling out, and then there definitely wouldn't be Tour de France and stuff like that later on. But I think that the, you know, I think that it seems very optimistic. Yeah, I agree. And being able to kind of get riders from the Tour de France to World Championships is going to be a real logistical nightmare for teams and riders, and almost impossible. Certainly from a time trial perspective, you'll get people like they do in the Vuelta pulling out in the kind of second or third week to get ready for the World Championships, which people kind of accept as a thing that happens in the Vuelta, but in the Tour de France, that would be new. And I think that that would devalue the race a little bit if people are saying that, you know, if the field suddenly gets decimated in the final week because everyone's worried about winning Worlds. So yeah, I see it being something that they kind of needed to do. They needed to display that there was going to be some backing behind having a Tour de France, but I wouldn't be surprised if it changes in the next like couple of months.
Yeah, I put it out there on Instagram today, trying to get general gist and opinion, and I think the general consensus was it's too early to currently commit to anything. There's a lot of chat that a lot of the chat was sort of saying there's a very high chance it could be a second wave around that time, like, because places will have started to pretend, maybe not necessarily come out of lockdown, and therefore that's the chance when you get second waves. Like, they're finding second waves in China at the moment from people coming in from Russia, basically. Yeah. So there's still no cure. Like, it's a serious situation. You know, the Olympics all being rescheduled kind of says it all. Like, to me, the Olympics is the biggest sporting event, like, full stop. It's every 4 years. While, you know, the Tour de France, I think, is known to be the biggest sporting event that happens every year. So, yeah, it's a tricky one.
Yeah, as a logistical exercise as well, you are moving people around the country. So it's not like you're, you know, you're not, you can't do something like have a velodrome where it can be very well contained and athletes can race and be kept apart from each other and things like that. By nature of it, the Tour de France is engaged with its audience, and a large part of the race is that you're by the roadside or you're hanging around at team buses beforehand and afterwards, and you're going to podium ceremonies and people are meeting people and getting interviews and things. And if Tour de France does exist and those things aren't the same, then I think it'll be in stark contrast to, you know, years gone by, and it'll look like a very, very different race. It won't be a Tour de France like we've known it, even if it does take part in August like they want it to.
I mean, it must be so impossible to try and police that as well, though. Like, you think it travels around the whole of France, to try and police people not being able to spectate must be like, I mean, it's a logistical nightmare.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a logistical nightmare anyway. So I mean, it's not my area of expertise running mass stage races and things. We organize little time trials in the UK and they're difficult enough, but trying to do something like the Tour de France with all the infrastructure that comes with it, I have no idea how to get my head around something like that. So I'm sure it's very difficult.
I saw because I went out there for stage 18 last year, and I went out there with Skoda and got like a bit of a I kind of got an insight into it a little bit, and it just looked like chaos, like literally like chaos. Like it was insane. And like I was in one of the team cars being like driven around, and they're like how strict they are to a schedule. So it was the stage before they had the landslide everything where stage got cut short. It was just bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. So I mean, and then also trying to shove three grand tours into basically the last quarter of the year just sounds like, as a rider, I'd be sitting there thinking shit. Well,
no one wants to give up on their grand tour, do they? So you know, you of course people are gonna want to not postpone theirs if no one else is, but yeah, it does seem interesting the new calendar. But I mean, it's, you know, they have to do that. Like, you can't just say, oh no, we're going to bin it off, because then you will get places like, I mean, from the looks of it, the guy who runs the CCC team is just looking for an excuse to jump ship. And a big announcement like the Tour de France not existing would certainly aid that decision if he did.
Yeah, I mean, you could see teams could fold.
Yeah.
Which is worrying.
I think, yeah. If teams fold, then the license is up for grabs, and then you might see Pro Conti teams like or other back teams kind of jumping up. I think the teams most at risk of folding are the ones who are more sponsor driven than others. So if you have a team that's bankrolled by a fan or someone who's got the ability to stay afloat, and the running a Tour de France team or a World Tour team is a small percentage of the overall business, then they'll be all right. So you've got, you know, teams mm-hmm. like Ineos or Israel Cycling Academy, Israel Startup Nation. In the past, teams that were, you know, run by Tinkoff and stuff like that, where there's enough money kind of to kind of just keep going in a bad year. But the teams who rely on sponsors who are within cycling, who are going to have problems keeping themselves afloat. You know, I think Sunweb's an example of that. They haven't really said anything about it yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was mm-hmm. difficult for them. CCC, that, you know, there's a footwear company, and any excuse to pull out of a bad decision if you're having to pay your riders like a lot of money, because it does cost a lot of money to run a World Tour team, then they can force majeure it and say we're out. So it's a really tricky one, and I think that it'll be impossible to predict what will happen. Who knows, you know, some of the big teams might just say no, we're done. And then you run into problems of like what happens to the riders then, because you can't just spread them all out amongst the other teams, because they'll be stretched as well. So you might have some very big name riders in that situation who have to drop down to Conti or Pro Conti, or maybe they'll retire because they're on the verge of it anyway and stuff like that. So it's bad news for the whole world for many more important reasons, but for the cycling world in particular, it's definitely something that's going to be an issue, I think.
I guess it leaves, with every challenge, there's opportunities as well. Like, you know, we never know what will come from it. I've got a really pointless claim to fame with CCC, ironically. So I used to design, when I worked in retail design, I used to design CCC stores.
Cool. That is very cool.
That's all right. They're pretty standard. But then so my claim to fame to the team is when they were a Pro Conti team, and I actually designed the kit.
Oh, right, wicked. That's awesome. Which kit was that? Was that
it was like the first it was a very, very, very orange one, like full orange.
What year was that?
2000 and, God, I want to say like 16.
Is that the year they went to the Giro?
Yeah, I think it might have been, actually.
Yeah, I think Marcin Bielobowski was riding for them at that year.
Yeah, he was. He was still riding for cool. then. But it was basically done, it was, to be honest, it's got to be this colour. Can you place the logos on it? That was pretty much it. Like, it wasn't really designed. It was quite a literal, we just need someone to place the logos on the template. Mate,
you can so claim that. I think that's absolutely fine.
Quite a funny one, though, isn't it?
That's brilliant.
I mean, the kit's got better, definitely. I quite like it, actually, the current one with the black shorts that fades in. I think it looks quite smart. Anyway, so I know a lot of people are going to ask this one. And so with AeroCoach, a big part of AeroCoach is getting people faster, quite simply. How the hell do you get someone faster?
So initially AeroCoach started up just from a rider positioning point of view, because obviously the riders, in terms of aero drag, which is, you know, the thing that's going to be slowing you down the most when you're riding on average, unless you're just a pure hill climber or something like that, you don't go down hills ever. then so your position accounts for, on a road bike, you know, it's about 80% of the overall aero drag. So we started out doing a lot of aero positioning work, which is what my background is in. And we were doing, working in outdoor velodromes, doing that using a very early version of the Garmin Track Aero system, which is basically like a very cool little bit of kit, which is gives you live numbers. So you can ride around a velodrome and you can see how aero you are as you're riding around. It's all beamed to a computer, which is the same system that's used by, you know, lots of World Tour teams and national federations. And we still use an updated version of it now. So that's what we started doing, because that gave the biggest kind of return on time. So you make someone more aero their position and you'll get a hell of a lot faster than you will do if you buy a new bike, for example. From there, we started making components and stuff. So I think the first thing we came out with was a saddle in conjunction with another company, which is kind of, it was designed around keeping you kind of planted on the bike and making sure you don't kind of move around so much. And again, that was in the same vein as kicking a body more aero. It was to stop you shuffling around, because the more you shuffle around, the less aero you're going to be. So although it's not an aero saddle necessarily, it helps to make you more aero, which is the idea. And then we started making other bits and bobs. That we did, started doing chain rings, a very subtly kind of non-circular chain, not an oval chain ring, but something that was based on a lot of the academic work that we did, because we built a special instrumented ergometer in the lab to analyze your pedaling stroke, and I used the data from that to design the chain rings, which is pretty cool actually. So they're in fact, have you ridden our non-circular ones, or did you get circular ones? I can't remember.
I've got non-circular ones.
Yeah, so what did you think of those ones? Because you rode them for a bit.
I rode them for a day. Non-stop for a day. To be honest, I'd be perfectly honest, I couldn't really tell the difference.
That was kind of the goal with those chain rings, is that what you don't want is something that's so dramatic that it takes you time to get used to, because then your pedal stroke and the way that your muscles fire adjust to that, and then it starts to become, you know, your pedal stroke is then adjusted to the chain ring, and then that's it.
I did use Osymmetrics at one point, just because everyone else bloody used them. I tried them out, and they are a significant jump. And I really noticed going from a bike with Osymmetrics to non-Osymmetrics. Well, with your ones, as I say, to be honest, I can't think of telling the difference. And you know, I've ridden them for a day. Yeah. That's pretty damn good.
For a whole day rather than just an hour in a day. The idea was that we didn't want people to have those chain rings on all their bikes, because it's just never going to happen. So you can swap from round rings to our slightly non-circular ones. And we changed the thing with those is it's all based around inertia. So you were doing a time trial, and the time trial version of our ring is has less of a change in gearing during the pedal stroke compared with the the inner ring that we do, which is you'd use if you're climbing, where it's a bit more dramatic, where the inertia is a lot lower. Mm-hmm. And when the inertia is higher, so your wheel speed is higher and the momentum is greater when you're doing a time trial, your pedal stroke is quite consistent. So you don't really want to have a big jerky chain ring that changes your pedal stroke really, really weirdly. So the biggest chain rings that we do that are, I think it's a 62, it's almost perfectly round. It's not like very dramatic. But then the inner chain rings that we do, because your pedal stroke is quite jerky when you go uphill, when you're using an inner chain ring, it mimics that action a little bit more. So it's slightly more non-circular. And they're made out of carbon, which helps to reduce the friction a little bit. I mean, the thing is, we're not claiming that these things are going to save you like 10 watts or something. Like it's a very small improvement, but they're stiff, they're a bit lighter, they kind of look cool. And when you get them wound up to speed, certainly the time trial ones, they feel a little bit like a flywheel, and you don't have to get accustomed to it. And when when we first brought them out, it was a few years ago, and not a lot of people were doing single chain rings at that time. So it was kind of like a new thing for time trialists to go one by, was starting to become more popular. It was just like a nice option for people, because it had long teeth on it, so you just stuck the chain ring on, took your front mech off, and saves a couple of watts aerodynamically to do that, and people, that's pretty commonplace now, is for people to go one by on their chain rings. Not because of us, but like just the way the industry's gone in that direction with more speed on the back, like 11 and 12 speed, it means you can get away with it a bit more.
Do you think it makes a massive difference, the one by setup, the aerodynamically?
So with the aero wise, it depends how you define massive. So it saves, like, it depends what you're going from and to as well. So if you go, we did a test where we got a Tiagra double chain set with a front mech, mechanical yeah. front mech, and then we swapped it out for a track chain set with a single ring and no front mech, which had a narrower Q factor, which is the distance between your feet, and that was 9 watts quicker at 45k an hour, which is plenty. But then because the narrow Q factor brought the rider's legs in a bit, some of it's going to be down to that. But with a double chain set, you can't narrow the Q factor because you start to get into clearance issues and things like that. So I think that aerodynamically, if you just take the front mech off and you take the inner ring off, it's normally like a few watts. You know, from a biomechanical perspective, if you can do things like playing with Q factor a little bit, because for trained cyclists, reducing your Q factor slightly on a road bike is often, not always, but often good. Then, you know, it does start to add up. But it also depends on the kind of races you do. Like, I do a lot of UCI races abroad, and they tend to be quite technical and kind of hilly and things. So this year, yeah. I kind of decided, well, there's not a lot of racing at the moment, but this year I decided that I was going to leave my front mech on, so that I can just have the opportunity to flick between gears if I need to, and probably put a big, like a 50 tooth chainring on the inside and then a 58 on the outside, just to have a better close nice. Ratio.
Because for the National 24 last year, I think I rode a 58. I rode two, and I rode, what would it be? 50. No, it was a 60-44. I rode a 60 because I rode a 58-44 for the year yeah. before. And I went up to a 62 for last year. And loads of people were saying to me, like, oh, how can you turn that gear? And I was like, well, when you get up to speed, it's not that bad. You've got the inertia behind you and you've got the momentum going. It's actually fine.
But also, you choose the same gear. Like, if you're on a 60, no one's going to give you shit if you're riding a 54-14, for example, on the back. But you ride a 60-15. Yeah. Or a 60-16, and it's pretty much the same gear. It's like four exactly. teeth on the front is give or take one tooth on the back, depending on where you are in the cassette. So all you do is just choose bigger gears on the back, and it's a little bit more efficient that way too. So yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's like I've got a when I do training at the track, I think I've got a 62 or a 60 front chainring, and everyone's like, "Oh, you're on such a massive mm-hmm. gear." It's like, no, I'm on a 95 inch. I'm on like smaller than a lot of people there, but it just looks, it's a big poser gear. Like, I do realize that, but yeah. but it's the same gear as everyone else. It's just a little bit more efficient because you're not, the chain's not having to bend around the cog so much.
Yeah, that's always been my theory, is that if the chain is got less kinks yeah. in it, it's more efficient. So I saw someone at the, I can't think what World Champs it was. It wasn't Yorkshire. I think it was the year before, 2018. And there was a guy that was on a Cervelo, and he set it up one by with a massive chain ring on the front. But then he was riding a Shimano XTR Di2 rear mech with like a 36 cassette or something on the back, or 38 cassette on it.
I wonder if it was Martin Toff Madsen when...
Yeah, that sounds like the one.
He ran one by when they were in Norway. Was it Norway? Where they had to go up the hill at the end? Or Austria?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure in Norway. I was there, actually, helping another rider. And I'm pretty sure I saw that he had 11-36 one by setup, which I thought was, it worked. He did real well. But the rider that we were helping had a double setup, and we had to plan where he was going to make the front shifts. Because you can't really like screw it up at the World Championships, and the approach to the climb at the end, it was basically like a rolling course and then a big killer climb at the very end of it. But to enter the climb, it was cobbled, so you couldn't do your front shift there because you might drop your chain. So we had to like mark out a point on the course where he's going to do his front shift before he got to the cobbles. It was all very technical and cool. But
I've just found a photo of that bike. It was Martin Toff Madsen, and he was riding a 62-tooth single ring on the front and a 42-cassette on the back.
That is
apparently
fantastic. That is, yeah, that is brilliant. 62. That's.
I mean,
That's you start to run into clearance problems when you have chain rings that big. Although I will tell you, we did do we made a 100-tooth chain ring for someone like a few weeks back or a month ago, I think. And they were using it for, I think they were using it for like a roller racing record, where you stick a bike on rollers and put a speedo on it and see what you can get up to. I don't know what the regulations around that sort of thing are. Pump your tires up real hard, I suppose. But yeah, he wanted a 100-tooth chain ring, and he was like, "Can you do it?" And we were like, "Yeah, why not?" So we made this massive thing that weighed like half a kilo.
So that's the biggest one you've ever done, is it?
100-tooth, yeah. It was a beast.
How big was that, like the diameter of that? That must
I've got
huge.
A picture of it somewhere. I think we put a picture on Instagram which had a knife and fork either side of it, and it didn't look out of place. So when you say dinner plate chain ring, this thing literally was that big. But yeah, I think there's a picture on Instagram.
Oh, okay, cool. We'll make sure I'll put like a link to it in the description. So with the aero testing, you do, when I did mine, we did like half a day in an outdoor velodrome, which, so my, how it went with me was, it's like half a day on the outdoor velodrome, which was where we did the big changes. And then we did half a day indoors in a wind tunnel where we did the really refinement and tweaking and adjusting.
And that's, it's kind of nice. Like we have three different locations when we do aero testing with people. Outdoor velodromes, which, I don't think a lot of people do that, to be honest. And it's nice because we've got a really good location to do it. And the data we get is pretty good. It means that we can charge people a bit less. So like as an entry to doing aero testing and things, that's really like a really popular session for us because you don't have to spend as much money as going to the wind tunnel. And then indoor velodromes, which is what we've done for years and years and years. And then wind tunnel testing, which we've done in various places. But the new Bourbon Tunnel that was built in Evesham is quite close to us. So we're quite lucky in that we've got all three facilities that are within distance of our HQ. So we can kind of flip between them as and when we need to. The data we get from all of them matches up the way that we collect the data. So obviously outdoors, you've got sort of like more swirling wind and things. The way we collect data in the velodrome, although there isn't wind, as you go into the bankings, there is an increase in your angle, which is the angle of attack of the airflow on the rider. So you're not just seeing dead on wind the whole time, which is, I think, a misconception that people think when they look at velodromes. And then the wind tunnel, you can simulate whatever you want. And you remember the way we were doing stuff with you is that we were kind of swinging you around as we were collecting data. So it's not just head on wind again. As we were collecting our numbers, we were moving you from left to right to simulate moving wind around you. And it's important that you do that as well, because otherwise you end up getting like weird numbers out of a wind tunnel that don't really represent how things match up.
That's why I've seen some people who've had like wind tunnel tests done, and the position that they come out of, they've just done like a wind tunnel test and they walk out of it of a position, and I'm just like, I don't know how you can sustain that outside. You can't see it.
Yeah, and it's a I think if you only work in one location, it can you can kind of like, you can end up doing things that might not work quite so well. So I think for us, working in three different locations really forces us to do things that will work outdoors. And yeah, the not seeing where you're going thing is always a bit of a bugbear for me, because you can give someone a position in the wind tunnel and say, oh yeah, you're going to save 50 watts or something, off you go, and think you're great. But if the rider goes out and like can't see where they're going, or tries to do what you might have told them and goes and crashes or something, it's just not good for anybody. So making sure that you're stable on the bike is a big part of what we do, and that you're kind of settled on it. And that was something that we played with your saddle position when we were doing an outdoor test quite a bit, to make sure that you were kind of like settled as much as possible, to then allow you to kind of move into a more squeezy position and see how that worked when we went to the tunnel. So it's not just about aerodynamics. It's about making sure that you're kind of nice and stable and that you can see where you're going. Obviously, if you're doing things like track riders and stuff, you can just get people to look at the black line. It's a little bit different, the way that you collect data is a little bit different too, but certainly for outdoor riders, you know, the last thing you want is to be put in a position where you're looking at directly at your front hub and just wondering if you'll survive the race. So it's a different one. And then obviously different types of riders have different requirements. So not just from a anthropometric point of view, you know, people have different flexibilities and body shapes and things, but also if you're testing someone, so if we're doing someone for a UCI rider, for example, like a professional, then you need to be more careful about making sure that they can output high power in whatever position you put them in, rather than a UK time trialist who tends to ride more flat events that don't need lots of kind of getting out of the saddle and smashing it and pushing on over the tops of drags and things that are, you know, 10% hills or whatever, and coming out of corners at 1,000 watts. It tends to be more kind of like consistent effort, kind of a a mid-level aerobic effort that you might do for a 25 or a 50 or something, whereas a UCI time trialist needs to be able to attack corners like a crit and really smash the power down. So you, with the UCI rider, you focus more on power to weight and the ability of the rider to output power as well as CDA, whereas with a UK rider, because the effect of traffic going past you that you get in a UK TT really speeds you up, and it speeds you up more the more aero you are, you can focus a bit more on the aero side of things, and you can afford to do stuff that might take away that top end power, but knowing that the rider's not going to need to to stack out 1,000 watts every corner like you would do if you're doing a Tour de France or World's TT. And so it's very interesting, like, you know, having to approach those things in different ways. And you've got triathlon as well, and long distance try and short distance try and things. So doing all the aero testing is, it really does keep you on your toes, because everybody's different. And although you can get to a certain point by copying other people's positions, your most aero position is going to be, it's going to be a lot different from someone else's. And it'll change over time as well, as you become more flexible, or, you know, if you've changed equipment and things like that. So it's a constant evolution, really, when you're doing stuff like that.
It's fascinating, because like you when we did our aero testing, you look straight up at the differences between when we did it, we did my position, which was focused on 24-hour time trials, but ironically is the same position that I use for a 10 or a 25 or a 50 or a 100 or a 12 hour. It's exactly the same position. And then you contrast that with, say, George's position, which was pretty much purely focused on 10 mile TTs. And, you know, mine was high hand, you know, very high hand position, shrugging the shoulders down, while George, in contrast, was very much a low hand position. And like almost Superman, like, really.
It was more about, for George, it was more about keeping him low and getting him to kind of like squeeze into it, because you couldn't do that for 24 hours. That was a perfect example of how different riders' requirements will result in a different position. I mean, I've changed my aero position since I started doing all this UCI stuff. I used to have a very different one, and obviously there are regulations around saddles and things like that. So it's been a bit of an evolution with me personally, trying to sort it out. And I'm not quite finished yet, but yeah, it is.
What are the kind of regulations that the? Because I to be honest, I don't really understand it so much, because I don't do UCI TTs. What sort of regulations do they have around your position?
So, I think that for people in the UK, it's something that people just don't really worry about so much. It's so alien to them to have constraints on where you need to put your handlebars and saddle and things. Whereas the riders that we work with, and, you know, we do a lot of work with people from Europe and further afield. Like, we had a guy fly over from New Zealand to have a session with us at one point, which is hilarious. He was actually, it's a cool story. He was a pilot who flew for Qantas, and he organized one of his flights to coincide with an aero testing slot. So he flew hundreds of people over to the UK and then stayed over for like 2 days and then flew back. He was so jet lagged when he turned out. It's hilarious. Lovely guy. But UCI rules, if people don't know what they are, It mainly focuses around the location of your hands in relation to your elbows, the amount of reach that you can have on the bike, and also your saddle position. So your saddle can't be as too far forwards, and your hands can't be too far forwards as well, so the ends of your shifters. And what it means is that you can do like little kind of sneaky trick things where if you put shorter cranks on, it makes it a little bit better for power production in UCI position, because you can't have your saddle so far forwards. If you have like really long cranks, then your feet are too far away from you. On a UK time trial bike, you just put the saddle further forwards to get yourself over the, you know, over your feet when they're horizontal, when the cranks are horizontal, but you can't do that in UCI. So shorter cranks are a little bit better. The reach thing is a bit of a ball ache sometimes, but it's not so bad. And I think usually what we see is that UCI positions will cost you in terms of aerodynamic drag to start with. So if we have someone who comes to a session who says, I've been riding in a non-UCI position, but I want to do Masters Worlds or something and I want to be UCI, when we put them into a UCI position straight away, it nearly always results in a penalty. And then we have to spend the session working our way back to their starting position and hopefully beyond that too. Whereas for UK time trial stuff, they did have some regulations about where your elbows could be and things, and then everyone just like flouted them and they said, oh, I can't be bothered to enforce it. So, well, it's just, you know, in UCI events, you have to have jigs on the start line. And I'll tell you what, I did do a funny one once where I was doing a 10 mile road bike TT in Indonesia, which was an experience. It was 42 degrees on the start line, my Garmin said, and everyone was just, it was so hot and really humid as well. So it was really oppressive heat. And I was worried because there are still regulations on road bikes, mainly around how light they are, but there are some regulations on saddle position that are the same as TT. And I wanted to do quite well. I ended up coming second, but I wanted to do quite well. So I didn't want to get my, you know, bike failed afterwards. So I was scouting around for commissaires and I said, is there a bike check anywhere? And the guy looked at me and said, him over there, that guy over there with the hat on, he's the commissaire. So I was like, okay. So I walk over to the guy. And normally when you do a bike check, they have a set of scales and they have a jig, and they put your bike up against the jig and then they have little measuring bits on the jig to see whether you're in spec or not. The guy just looked at me and he grabbed my bike and he just like hefted it and then looked into the air a little bit and put it down. He's like, yeah, you're fine. And then just gave it back. So that was my experience of it. An Indonesian UCI bike jig. And then you have experiences where, you know, the jigs are wrong. I was helping out one of our riders at National Track Champs this year, and the jig, they were calibrating their spirit level, because your armrest can't be more than 15 degrees in a UCI bike, and they were calibrating the spirit level off the jig, but the crossbar that they were putting the spirit level on to zero it was off center. So everyone was being told that their armrests were 16, 17 degrees or something. I'm like, oh my goodness, like, I know for a fact that it's fine. And they were like, no, I'll change them. So, it was just little things like that. And so that's why the CTT, to be honest, probably quite rightly, have said, we're not going to worry about making people do. So CTT's UK time trials is, we're not going to worry about making people do stuff like that, because it's volunteer led and you're not going to have a jig on the start line of every race. So it would be a complete nightmare.
Could you imagine it, like turning up to a 10-mile TT at like 6 o'clock in the morning, and some guy shouts a jig and goes, "Nope, can't race."
Well, they did do a thing once where they, without telling anyone, although I suppose you wouldn't, would you? They started scanning everyone's bikes for motors at the women's national 50. I think it was men's national 50 as well. And so you'd roll. The riders were rolling to the start line. It was somewhere near Nottingham, I think, and they were going from the HQ to the start. And before they got to the start, there was another lay-by, and they were getting accosted by people saying, I want to scan your bike. And the riders were like, well, this isn't a CTT regulation. What are you talking about? Plus, I've only given myself enough time to get to the start line to do my ride, not to someone to wave an iPad all over it. And a couple of riders missed their start because they were scanning the bikes and having pictures taken of the riders and putting it on some database or something. And it was all a bit weird. So I don't think they managed that very well. And I think the experience of trying to do that probably led to not wanting to to do anything on the start line and whatever, which is fine. I think obviously if someone starts to really take the mick with regulations, then they'll react to that But for the moment, the way that the CTT is run is that it's a very easy entry into the sport, and it's just a nice way to do some racing for quite cheaply. So adding barriers to that is a bad idea.
Yeah, it's really for me, like, time trialing is a good way to be like, I don't like crits or road races or anything like that, and it's a good way to be competitive and not just race against other people there, but, you know, race against yourself. And as you say, it's very friendly and welcoming, and it's just a nice scene, isn't it, generally? Like, it's every TT I've ever done, there's always been really nicely run. There's always been, like, cakes and coffee and stuff at the end, and, like, it's just a good vibe to it. It's super chill, normally run by old people who just enjoy bike racing.
Basically. Yeah, and it's very much a British institution as well. Like, it's been around for so long that, and the thing that we say to like newcomers and stuff, because we try and do a bit of a push for road bike time trials, because I think a lot of the time people think, oh, I've got to have a 10 grand TT bike to take part in things, and the CTT regulations, like, you could turn up on a Brompton if you wanted and you wouldn't be turned away. And it's we've been trying to, like, although this year obviously it's been completely shot down because of the pandemic thing, we had a road bike national series going where we wanted to, like, let people enter TTs on road bikes who might not have had a TT bike, or even if they did, you know, still enter it too, and try and kind of show people that it is so welcoming. Because yeah, you just it's a very low barrier for entry. And
you could enter on a Brompton.
Sorry,
you could do it.
Yeah,
on
if you wanted to. Oh. Yeah, why not? And I remember doing a TT once, and some guy turned up on his commuting bike. It was like a flat bar hybrid, and he was dead chuffed. He got under 35 minutes for a 10, and he was happy. And the thing I think to bear in mind is that when you do a TT, I remember I got my sister to do her first one, and she was worried. She was like, oh, you know, it's, what people are going to think if I don't, you know, go under 30 minutes or don't go under 40 minutes or something. I was like, you have no idea. No one really minds what time anyone else does. Like, no one's that bothered. Like, everyone's just trying to either race themselves. Maybe they're trying to race their mate. But, like, if you come last, no one cares. Like, it's absolutely not. And, you know, I remember we organized Midland Championships one year, and there was a woman there who got under 40 minutes, and she was like, oh, is that any good? I'm like, are you kidding? That is awesome. Like, just even getting to the start line of a race, and it being her first race, and getting round and not getting lost, and, you know, managing to finish the race and everything, is fantastic. And no one minds what time you do, because everyone's different ability at the end of the day.
Yeah, exactly. As long as you're giving it your best shot, it doesn't matter at the
exactly,
end of the day.
Exactly. So, yeah, no excuses. Just finish the race and make sure you've pedaled as hard as you can. And then there's always another one next week. Or in the current situation, right, there aren't any for ages.
All right, chuck this one at you. What is the best, like, value TT bike you could get, and road bike at the moment?
Best value? Something from Argos? Like, what? Best value in terms of, like, aero performance? Is that what you asked?
Yeah. Why not? That
so we
good.
So we did a. Back in 2015, I think it was, we actually built a bike for Richard Bussell, who won the National 10-Mile Championships. And it only cost us like 980 quid, I think. We cobbled it together off, like, I think a lot of people didn't believe that we built a bike for that money, because it had a disc wheel, it had a tri-spoke and everything. And I remember someone saying that they saw it at a race like 2 months later that Rich did. And they were like, I had a closer look at it, and yeah, it was definitely a 980-pound bike, because it was falling to bits. But that was based around a Trek. It was an old carbon Trek frame that we knew was pretty fast. In terms of best value, there are a couple of secret aero bikes that I think people don't realize. So although they're quite heavy, the old aluminium Trek Speed Concept bikes are really, really pretty good. They use the same down tube shape as the carbon Speed Concepts, and I think the seat tubes are the same as well. They've got pretty good geometry. They're like easy to work on, so threaded bottom brackets and things, and like we've seen them go on eBay for like £200-300 for like complete bikes. So for a TT bike, if you can pick up an old aluminium Speed Concept, that is absolutely, like, hands down the fastest, cheapest thing you can get. Most of our team riders ride either Cervelos or Treks. We tend to recommend those because they kind of, the geometry is pretty good, and they tend to like perform pretty well most of the time. You know, you can spend like a bazillion pounds on a Pinarello Bellide TT, which are very, very fast bikes. But if you have a nice bike set up, then spending the money elsewhere on things like tires and stuff is the way to go.
Sure, and surely most of the biggest factor of drag is the rider itself.
Yeah,
it?
Absolutely. So, you know, if you can afford to spend more on getting the rider more aero, so whether that's by getting a better skin suit, or, you know, getting your aero position sorted out, or even just doing a lot of training in the aero position, because that's free, that doesn't cost you anything, and, you know, making sure that you can hold the position and keep yourself nice and stable is hugely important. And I think that's something that sometimes people people miss a little bit, but yeah, training in the aero position is an absolute win. But yes, and from a road bike point of view, I don't know, I think there are lots of kind of nice aero road bikes. I'd go for something, I'd go for something secondhand, that's maybe a few years older. One of the older Cervelos probably could, because they've been pretty good for a while. Like the old S2 and S3 are like pretty good bikes. They don't have amazing clearance on the back end for some modern wheels. So they're a little bit tight in the chainstays, for some wheels. That might be a consideration. But the Giant Propel as well, even the very first edition Giant Propel was a really good bike. And then obviously some of the newer ones, like the Trek Madone's a really good one, as well as the Specialized Venge. In fact, we had a Venge in the tunnel, and we did it bike only, and the bike only drag on the Venge was like, it was basically a TT bike. The guy had like deep section wheels on it and stuff, but it was good. It was the new Venge is a very cool bike.
It's a nuts looking bike, isn't it? Like the new Venge, how they've kind of a little bit of me still likes the McLaren Venge, that one. Like, I think that's just like a classic bike. Was that the first one?
That was the first Venge they came out with, and it had that kind of top tube that turned into a chain seat stay.
That is just a beautiful piece of art more than anything. And I've got a friend that works for McLaren, and they have, I think, one of the first ones that was produced in the McLaren headquarters, which is really, really cool. But like that bike, seeing how that bike's evolved over time has been quite fascinating, actually. Like, it's really, look, the similarities now between the Venge and the Tarmac are quite astounding as well. And there's definitely a thing that the more like GC style all round the bike is taking a lot of aero elements to it now. And it's very, very clear in all bike ranges. Like, the biggest, you know, one of the biggest examples that stood out to me of recent time was Focus, the Azalco Max, which was always Focus's like top end road bike. It was always quite traditionally, you know, round tubes, very traditional looking bike. And then they refreshed it and it's now an aero road bike.
And even the bikes that people are using as their climbing bikes, they're still putting aero tech in there, like the Tarmac and the Cannondale. I can't remember which one it is. It's the Super 6, is it?
System 60.
They've all got like these little tweaks to try and help, because people know how much like aero is important. And if you're looking at pictures of bikes and things and seeing how they evolve, one of the most interesting things for us is the seat tube, because it's a very difficult tube to get right. From an aero point of view, it creates an awful lot of drag, and it's like a big issue, to be honest. And seat stays as well. It might not seem like it's important, but it's why everyone's going for drop seat stays, and why some bikes have got some very weird arrangement. Like the new Shiv's a great example of that, Shiv TT, the Specialized Shiv TT. The seat tube's very dramatically different from what you've seen before. Big gap between the seat tube and the back wheel. And then the seat stays come off at a proper angle. I mean, they've really pushed the UCI regs from that point of view, because you can't have the seat stays too low. And they've managed to push the little, you know, the boxes that you can use to stick your tubes in, as in the scope for movement. They've really pushed that out a little bit to get the seat stays as low as they can, with a bit of a horizontal entrance to them. So yeah, it's cool. It's really interesting to see how things change. Obviously, you are, you know, constrained by UCI regs, and the UCI can be interesting when it comes to that. And we do a lot of stuff Like we're constantly in communication with the UCI with all of our new products and things, trying to get stuff, make sure that we're not going to see any issues later on. And we had a particular issue recently where they tried to ban one of our components, which they'd previously said was fine. And then we had to come up with, you know, a huge justification as to why it's all right, including examples of other people who are doing exactly what we were doing. And they caved. They said, oh, yeah, no, it's fine. We're like, oh, thank goodness for that. Because we'd already sunk so much money into it. It was a solid, like, five-figure sum. It would have been a real pain. Well, especially because they previously approved it and then they just changed their mind. That's what annoyed me about it. But
isn't that quite standard DeFi with them, or is that
I think it. I don't know that they've a little bit. There's too much opinion has too much sway currently in terms of whether something is allowed or not. The rules aren't tightened up enough. So what we do now is we just. And we did this for one of our components, the thing that we did with the National Federation, like a big project. And from the get go, we were just sending them CAD files and just saying, "Is this okay? Is this okay? Is this okay?" Because we couldn't afford. We were working with quite a tight timeline, so we couldn't afford for them to come back at a late stage and say, "No, this isn't okay." And the way that we designed it, like they were, they didn't like a particular bit of it. And so we had to change it, and then suddenly loads of other teams were doing it. Was a track component, and loads of other teams were doing things that they told us that we weren't allowed to do, and then they changed the rules to say that they could get away with it, and we just wasted like 3 months worth of engineering time having to change stuff around. So yes, actually now I think about it, yes, they are quite annoying, but I understand the need to have regulation. Like I'm totally fine with that. It's just the application of it. And when I get a phone call saying, you know, from Switzerland saying, oh, by the way, you need to tell all of your athletes that have bought these things that they're going to have to be sent back and they can't use them. It was something that was used at World Champs, World Track Champs, as a different component, and no one can use it. And I was just like, I'm not doing that. Of course I'm not doing that. Are you kidding? So we had to, it was just a very stressful week. But we got someone won a World Champs using that particular component, so that was good, and it hopefully showed the UCI that that people wanted to use our kit rather than it just being some random component that they could get banned and no one would care about it. It was actually quite popular, so that was stressful, but we came out on top. I don't expect us for that to happen again though, so we're being very careful with any of the new stuff that we do.
I guess it's just like lessons learned, and on to the next one. The more you work with them, the more you can understand how they work at the end of the day.
And the guy's not unreasonable when you speak to them. It's Jean-Christophe Perrault, actually, is one of the people in charge of the material side of things, and then another chap. And they're not unreasonable, but once they've decided they don't like the look of something, and when we sent them the schematics for like the National Federation thing that we did, it looked real dramatic, and they were like, yeah, we don't like that. We're like, well, what don't you like about it? And they said, well, we're not sure, let us get back to you. And then 3 days later they came back with a new regulation that they'd invented because they didn't like the stem, and it was like, oh, give me a break, you know. The problem we're having now is that they're not replying to emails. I think the UCI have furloughed like 130 of their workers, so we have two projects that need to be approved, and so we're gonna have to get hold of someone somehow to make sure that we're not going to get any surprises further down the line.
So obviously this whole the pandemic we're currently in has had a big effect on you, and it's had an effect on projects, definitely, which in that's prime proof of it, like but I guess you can only do as much as you can, can't you, in these situations?
Yeah for sure. I think that we're taking the time to like consolidate some of the stuff we're doing, and it does give us time to work on projects that require a lot of focus. So we've got like a few World Tour teams that we're doing like different things with, whether it's, you know, data collection and or components, or like tweaking of the existing stuff and things like that. And it means that that'll all keep happening. Like that's not going to just disappear because those projects still running. Obviously, the error testing side of things, we're not doing any error testing at the moment, but that's fine. You know, we don't need to do the error testing. And people are still like buying stuff off us in terms of like things like armrests and chain rings and extensions, because you can still use those on the turbo. So having a nice comfy aero position is always the goal, whether you're on the turbo or outside. So it's definitely changed things. Like, you know, our people are working from home more, and we don't have to do quite so many like big bulk postal orders and things. So those guys don't need to come in. But yeah, it's just different, I think. It's certainly, it obviously it feels different. But because there's no racing, I think that's what's weird.
Because we all race
bikes, and that's the thing that you do at the weekend. Whereas now the weekends are kind of a bit more empty, and you don't need to fill it with work because you've got all your work done already. So that's what's feeling a bit weird at the moment. It's a bit frustrating too. My mum's just moved nearby to where I live, and I can't go and see her, which is, in the grand scheme of things, a very small. A small whinge, but
I completely get that as well. Like it was my dad's 60th birthday the other week, and I couldn't get him in the Isle of Man. He's a high risk person as well, and I'd planned to surprise him for his 60th, but couldn't do it. Like,
that's sad.
To be fair, he was completely understanding of it. Like, he was just like, fair. He was pretty cool. Nice of you to have tried, but yeah, like I've got my stepsister's wedding in October on Halloween, actually. So we'll see if that happens. Oh, no idea yet. She hasn't said anything about it. So
yeah, I mean, potentially. Who knows? Yeah, who knows? But we're having to get my mum to sort out internet, and she's got a smartphone now, so that's step one. We'll still be able to keep in touch and things, but it'd be nice to pop round. But as you said, bigger things are afoot than worrying about seeing my mum on the weekend.
So what would be your, like, give me like a couple of really quick and easy like tips that you could give to people who are looking for like quick and easy gains for time trialing or for crit racing and road racing as well? I guess it applies to both.
Cycling performance in general. I think the first one is tyres. Like, tyres are just by far the cheapest, fastest, easiest upgrade to make. And if you drill that down more, you go latex tubes, or you go going tubeless. If you've been using butyl tubes or something, then that's an absolute like easy win. We do a lot of data on that. We do a lot of private data for teams and federations on rolling resistance for like prototype tyres and things. People are moving away. A lot of the Pro Tour teams are moving away from tubular tyres these days, because the traditionally a tubular tyre from the sort of larger manufacturers will have a butyl tube sewn into it, and just putting a latex tube inside a tyre will speed it up loads, or having sealant instead of a tube. So tyres are good. We've got some data on our website for just free data for people who do time trials. Mainly focus around time trial tyres, showing the kind of performance improvements you can get. And tyres aren't that expensive for the savings that you can make. So, you know, you might be spending, I don't know, £50-60 on a tyre or something, but you'll get more from that than you will do if you, I don't know, buy a frame or something, if you choose the wrong one. So, definitely tyres are a real good one. And that applies to everyone. So obviously for road racing and crits, you need to have good grip and stuff like that. But if you're doing TTs, then something that won't puncture or is less likely to puncture but is the fastest thing possible is the way to go. I suppose related to that is tyre pressure. I think people get tyre pressures wrong quite often. With more modern tyres, they tend to be more supple, and with more modern wheels as well, because the internal rim width, so the distance between the hooks on the rim is wider on more modern wheels, it means that you can run a lower pressure because the contact patch is different than what you would have had on a wheel with like a 16 or 17 mil internal rim width. These days, they're like our wheels, I think, are like the deep section wheels we do are like 19 or 20 mil internal rim width. So the tire spreads out a little bit more, and you can run a lower pressure. So making sure you get the pressures right, and you can really go low. I mean, very experienced crit riders will know this, that you can do a crit at like 60, 70 PSI in some conditions, and it's totally fine. Whereas time trialists traditionally would be like, well, what do you put the tire up to? What it says on the sidewall? And so they're like risking splitting their nice deep section carbon rims apart because they put 180 PSI in their clinches. So getting your tire pressure right is good. You know, these days, less than 100 PSI for everybody, unless you weigh 110 kilos or something. And then, I mean, I'm high 70 kilos, sort of mid 70 kilos, depending on how many donuts I've been eating. And I run about like 80 PSI.
Yeah, you're the same as me. I'm about the same as me, because I'm the same. I mean, it's not necessarily donuts, but it tends to be. I actually baked. I like baking. Yeah. I've made. They were supposed to be hot cross buns, but I didn't have the right flour, so I just used self-raising flour, and they turned out to be like hot cross buns.
Very good. That sounds very tasty.
They taste incredible, to be fair. But yeah, I'm the same. Like, I ride about 80 PSI.
Yeah. So
that's my dog. One second. Hello.
Yeah, that's fine.
My partner coming in, so I've just unlocked the door, and my great sounding door system. Yeah, very loud. I'm the same sort of weight as you, and I run 80 pretty much on everything apart from off road.
Yeah, exactly. And you just don't really need to go any higher than that. And we've seen that if you err on the side of too low, it's always better than erring on the side of too high. So if you, let's say your optimal PSI is 80 for a 25 mil tire on a modern wide rim, and you put 100 in it, then it's going to cost you more watts than if you put 60 in it. So going too low is always a better plan rather than going too high.
Interesting. That's a good tip. Yeah. That.
Also, check your pump. Get some kind of tire pressure gauge or something. We've got some funky little Quark tire whiz things that will measure your tire pressure, so we calibrate all of our pumps to it, because pumps aren't necessarily correct. So you could be 5 PSI out without knowing it.
I have two different track pumps at home, one's like a tubeless one with like a big air valve on it, and one's not, and I don't think that either of the pressure gauges are correct on either of them, to be honest with you.
It's really interesting. We're hopefully going to do some data for people on tire pressures and stuff like that outdoors, and we're going to use this the Quark Tire Whiz is basically like a little sensor that screws onto the valve, and it measures the air pressure live, and it will beam it to your phone, and so you can see the PSI changing as you're riding as well as over time. So I think that'll be quite interesting to see how that responds, if we can get some logging data in different surfaces and stuff. We want to do some gravel tire testing as well, but it's just about finding the right location for that. We've nearly got all of the kind of stuff we need to do that. It's just finding the right location to get the data correct, because rolling resistance is like, it's massive, and it's something that we're doing kind of more and more of these days, both from a kind of, you know, interest point of view, because we need to help. We need to recommend tires, because we sell wheels, so we need to be able to recommend the right tires for people. But also from a development point of view, like we've had some, we had a really good tubeless tire from a pro team recently, and we're not allowed to put it on our little public graph, but like it's really good. And I might if I can get hold of another couple of sets, I might ride them this year, because they seem like really well, really good for puncture resistance, and they're nearly as fast as the fastest things that we've been testing. So that's been pretty cool. And then we got some prototype tubulars as well from another team, and they were terrible. Like I was really surprised. So they're, you know, having to make decisions about what kind of tyres they're going to have to use for TTs this year and stuff like that. But
so they might like scratch out the logos and use something else.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think that for a lot of teams, that going to tubeless is an easier win than working on tubular development and getting tubular tyres to be a lot faster. So teams are moving towards tubeless, but they're quite against going to tubeless for road racing. They want to all run tubeless for TTs instead, because the feedback we've got from the teams we work with is that they're worried about puncturing tubeless on a road bike, because you'll go down faster than you would do if you were doing it in a TT. So if you're in a bunch and you puncture a tubular, you can hold it up. But if you pump a tubeless tire and it sprays sealant everywhere and the tire just goes to zero PSI immediately and it starts coming off the rim, then you're in trouble. So that's why you still see Pro Tour teams running tubular tires for road racing. But for TTs, they're definitely moving in the other direction.
That's interesting. I've never thought of it like that.
Yeah, I think that there will be a situation where the tires are so good that the risk for punctures is so low that they're willing to take the hit. But it's lighter as well. Like tubular tires and wheels as a combo are pretty much always going to be lighter than a tubeless setup. So you're not going to be hindered by going uphill and things. But there's a very interesting, I haven't done it yet, but there's a very interesting calculation where if your rolling resistance increases by a certain percentage, it's because of the way the physics works. It's almost like adding weight to your bike. Because of the so if you go uphill and you have a faster rolling tire, it kind of, not perfectly, but it kind of flattens the gradient out a little bit because of the way wrong resistance the effect of the resistance on the system. So what I want to try and do at some point is do a little chart where it says, look, if you swap from this tire to this tire, and you're doing, even if you're doing a hill climb or going on a flat or something, it's like taking X amount of kilos off your bike, because I think that will highlight to people just how important it is.
Yeah, definitely. Nice. Cool. I'm going to now drop in my killer last question, which is 5 hacks or life tips.
I've been trying not to think about it.
Everyone does that. Sorry? Everyone does that. They go,
Hacks or life tips. I think I can probably go for like a very corny one, which is do things you enjoy. I've been very kind of over the course of my career, I suppose, I've really focused on doing things that I really wanted to do. So, you know, originally it was going to be academia, and then realized that that wasn't going to allow me to do the things that I really wanted to do. So I didn't care about the money and started doing work in sport, and then, you know, everything kind of spiraled from there. But yeah, don't worry about, and certainly don't worry about, if you know that that's something you want to do, then you're the best placed person to make that decision. If people around you are saying, "Oh, I'm not sure if that's going to be the right thing for you to do," but you're dead set on it, then only you will know, really. So I don't want to say follow your dreams, but if you have an idea of what you want to do, and the thing is, if you don't have an idea of what you want to do, explore doing different things, expose yourself to different scenarios and environments and things, because only then will you end up converging on the right decision. Otherwise, you end up getting stuck. Yeah. And so if people want to have, you know, a change, whether it's lifestyle, work or whatever, but they don't know what that change should be, then you should explore your environment and find out different things that you can. You might find things that you really don't enjoy, but in that process, and you may find things that you do, but that's certainly one of them, and something that I've always ever done the things that I've wanted to do, you know, whether it's from a professional point of view or whatever. So and it's worked out okay. I've got to an okay place so far.
Nice. I like that one.
I've got to come up with 4 more.
Right. Yeah.
Don't pump your tires too hard. No. I think I don't know. Make sure that so this is more of a kind of work thing, business thing. But make sure that you accurately display, if you're really passionate about something, make sure you accurately display that to other people.
So I love what I do, and I really, really do. And I think that when you're working with other people, it will rub off on them if you're excited about a project. So like we had a project with a para sports federation, which we might end up doing something totally out of the blue that we haven't done before. We've done work with para sport before, but this is a new one on us. Not aerodynamics, but more kind of engineering side of things. And it just sounds fantastic. And rather than just being like, yes, we'll do your project and we'll take your money and do it, it's more like, no, I really want to do this. And I genuinely believe that it sounds like a lot of fun. And people really respect that. And also say no to things that you think just might not be the right fit, or that you won't be able to devote enough of your attention to, because it just won't be the right thing for you to do. So I think that if you're keen on something, make sure that everyone knows that you're keen on something, and you'll find that everyone else gets kind of G'd up by that in the same way too. That's something that always I like for people to know if I'm excited about something for sure.
Nice. Okay, we've done three right. More.
I think so. Something that I had a discussion with my PhD supervisor at one point, where he said to me, I was riding my bike every. I tried to ride my bike every day, and he said to me, he's just like, oh, you're riding a bike too much. It's not. You're not spending enough time, you know, fully focusing on your PhD, which I thought was harsh to start with. I was very devoted to my PhD, but I said to him, I said, look, you know, I've never really disagreed with you before. We've never had an argument or something, but this conversation is, the end of this conversation is that I am going to do exercise every single day, because, it really does make you more productive. And just, you know, an hour's exercise a day. And like, I tend not to do that necessarily most days, like 40 minutes or an hour's exercise a day. You can always find time for that. Even if it's just like something that's exercise related, whether it's stretching or doing some yoga or something like that, just finding that time in your day where your head's always a little bit clearer than it would be if you're sat on the sofa on your phone and your head's spinning, or you're thinking about something, or you're sat on your computer or whatever. Finding some time for some kind of physical activity just makes you so much more productive. And it keeps you healthy and all that kind of thing too, you know. But I find that like an absolute, like I've ever since I was, you know, 13, 14, that's what I've done. And, you know, for the, you know, over 20 years since, I've been exercising nearly every single day in some capacity. And you just feel so much better for it. Obviously you get withdrawal symptoms if you can't then exercise, but then that makes you hopefully try to find the time to do it. And so, yeah, always try and find time to make time to keep your body ticking over, because it will really pay dividends in terms of your overall productivity. Yeah, for sure.
Nice. I like that one.
Yeah.
As someone that does that.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's different for people that don't tend to exercise. I suppose the people listening to this podcast are going to be, you know, ticking that box anyway. But even if it's like helping other people understand the importance, because then it sounds like a chore, but the value, the physical and mental well-being that you gain from just doing a little bit of exercise and getting yourself a little bit out of breath a few times a week, really, really, really pays off in all things. It helps to chill you out. It makes you more productive at work. And, you know, if you end up doing things like races or events and big rides and things, it makes them much more enjoyable too, rather than slogging around with low fitness. I try not to let my fitness slip too much if I can. So what are we on now? Two more. I don't know. Reduce your screen time. I can't say that because I don't. So I'm not really sure that can be a Zav life hack. be organized with your food's quite a good one.
That's a good.
Yeah, it's again, it kind of comes down to the like physical well-being thing. Like if you, so I mean, obviously this isn't the right thing for everybody, but I use a meal replacement shake because I'm traveling quite a lot, and that was a huge win for me when I started doing that for breakfast and lunch, and then have like a cooked supper when I'm somewhere that'll allow it. But that was a massive win for me, just having consistent food, because otherwise you're like eating out service stations and things. And just having rubbish food with, you know, processed sugar and stuff like that. So I think not so much like choose a particular diet or, you know, not have this particular food or whatever, but just if you can spend a bit of time taking care of your food, that will really, it improves your mood like enormously.
Massive.
Yeah. And it means that, yeah, you can just be more consistent from day to day in terms of how you feel, how productive you are, and things like, yeah, your tiredness and stuff like that. That was a big one for me when I started doing, I started being a bit more consistent with my food. So that was quite a good one. Last one. Yeah. I suppose so far it's been a lot of kind of like physical and mental things. I don't know, other life hacks. I'm not sure. I think that it's tricky, isn't it? Because you only end up being able to recommend things that you've done, and so your experiences are related to that. And I'd consider that like running a business isn't necessarily something that a lot of people do. So a lot of the life hacks and things that I end up recommending from that point of view are related to that. But I don't know. I'm not sure.
I mean, the tire pressure one is a big one on its own right, to be honest with you, mate. I mean,
tire pressure, always have the right tire pressure, whether it's your car or your bike, is always going to be is always going to be important. Yeah. I think that focusing. I suppose the other recommendations I've done so far have been like making sure I'm focusing that you're in good nick and healthy in a good place, because that will make sure that everything you do is like that you feel happy with everything that you do, trying not to make rash decisions and stuff like that. I often come up with stupid ideas and have harebrained decisions and have to run it through a few people to talk me out of dropping five figures on a project that's just not gonna be such a good idea. But I think that once you've committed to it, let's say you're making a decision, whether it's about moving house or whether it's about making a carbon part for the Olympics or whatever, once you've committed, understand that, don't let the doubts creep in. Like, understand that the process of getting to those decisions, to getting to that final decision, is one that you've made and, you know, confirmed in your own head, and then run with it. Everything will be fine if you commit to decisions, even if you think that, oh, maybe it could have been better or whatever. If you commit, then you'll find that things tend to have a positive outcome, in my experience. But it's that commitment and steadfastness that that makes stuff really really, really tick over, rather than like worrying too much about small doubts or what other people might think or something like that. If you've made a decision, then that is the right decision for you. And so if that's your final answer from a Who Wants to Be a Millionaire perspective, then you've got to run with it and take the consequences, good and bad.
Nice. Jeez, I think that was five ridiculously good tips, actually.
You might need to, edit down my slight rambling around it, but there'll be a quote in there, I'm sure.
Awesome. I'm gonna wrap it up there. Like, that's been nearly an hour and a half of very fascinating chat. So thank you so much, Zab, for that.
No problem at all. Look forward to
it. Poet and I didn't even know it.
You were sorry?
Poet and I didn't know it then. Awesome. Yeah, that was brilliant. Thanks so much for your time. Super, super fascinating. And I'm sure we will have another catch up at some point further down the line when we know what's going on with the world of cycling.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, no, I look forward to
everything.
It. Hopefully see it at a race at some point as well.
Yeah, yeah, it'd be nice, yeah. Wouldn't it? We might just end up doing them all on Zwift.
Yes, exactly, yeah. How
work out the CDA of Zwift, mate. That's your next challenge.
People have done it. People have done it. There is a CDA on Zwift for different like riders' characteristics and things and rolling resistance and stuff. People have worked it out. Because, yeah, wow. I know. I don't want to do it because I don't want to get annoyed because it will be higher than what my actual CDA is, I'm sure. So if I get smashed in races by tiny 50-kilo people, it will just make me even more annoyed.
Yeah, don't do it. Don't allow yourself to do it. Cool. Thanks so much, mate. I'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, Chris.